Chapter 14. It was a little weird. You passed a town called Jersey Shore, and that was way in eastern Pennsylvania. And Chris remembered a week he spent once at the real Jersey Shore. And coming back from there that time, a guy driving and his girlfriend in front, Chris and some other guy in back, traffic stops on the turnpike, and the guy asks the girlfriend how she'd feel about him breaking the law and driving on the shoulder for a while, which a few people were doing, and she says that would be grossly unfair to everyone else who's obeying the law and waiting out the stoppage. And the boyfriend considers it for a couple minutes, what she said, and then swings onto the shoulder. Chris made a mental note a couple times to find out whatever happened to that relationship, but he never did. This morning, it wasn't going to kill you. Adjusting your angle from the Big Apple to Bucks County. In fact, it was probably shorter. You continue on 80 as normal, except at Berwick. You jump on 81 South. Then after a while, 476, and you're home free. Door to door, leaving the Hi-Ho Inn. 5 hours and 22 minutes, it said. Chris didn't know much about Bucks County except what he loosely remembered from history class, that there was quite a bit of British activity there 100 years before the Revolutionary War blew everything open, and there were manors and stuff. Glancing down at the map a half hour away, he could see the appeal for a guy like Nick. You were north of Philly, but only an hour or two. You were a couple hours east of New York tops, and something you didn't think of but likely applied to Nick, 2 hours from Atlantic City. They seemed to divide it into Upper, Central, and Lower Bucks County, and the respective towns were Quakertown, Doylestown, and Bristol. But his town, checking the note again, Ned's info, would be Beddingham, also in Lower Bucks if he was reading the map right. And of course, you thought you were a half hour away quite a while back, but you had to zigzag around once you were technically in Bucks. And this involved some secondary roads, his particular one including a bit of up and down, not mountains, but short, steep, and curvy hills. And finally, you did see Beddingham up front, and Chris found a diner and stopped for a Coke. One impression today, the countryside was rich with spring, stuff blooming up the wazoo, little creeks and waterways running fast and disappearing into stands of what Chris guessed were flowering cherries, and maybe dogwoods and magnolias mixed in too, all of it feeling pretty dang fresh and vibrant. The effects of a real winter, in other words, not a California one, meaning nature had been seriously held back for 4 months and now was making up for it. The menu in the diner had some local tourist info on the back, and it informed you that William Penn himself founded Bucks County, and geez, that was probably the guy they named it Orange State after. The main thing, Chris was thinking now, adding a little perspective to the situation based on the last episode, not Roland so much, but the other one he had to travel to, was come at it a little different this time. That had been pretty torturous, no other way to frame it. The absurd business of going to Reno, to Montana, and like a slingshot gone haywire, all the way back to Beacon, the Central Valley, and then the mess there, the endless following the bozo around, not to mention having to find him in the first place, and then once you were on him, all the waiting. As he told Dr. Moore, he'd at least met the high school guy Gillette, so that killed an hour at one stage, and he did envy and admire that kid, even after the kid disclosed he was dealing with a major issue. Dr. Moore hadn't pressed him on it, really, but she should have, this being a common enough theme, wasn't it? Chris always looking to go back somewhere and start fresh and redo his own stuff. But here, today, don't screw around. Kind of like the example of those achievement tests again. You overwork it, you probably don't come out any better, and you may end up getting it wrong. Chris checked the time. It was 1:20. In fact, If you handle things during business hours or thereabouts, you might not even have to check into a motel. Not the worst thought, since judging from this tourist info attached to the menu, you didn't have your typical all-American motels in Bedingham, but instead, your country inns and B&Bs, and Chris supposed that's how it had been around here for a long time, and you weren't likely to get many new town council people welcoming in the modern age enough to approve a Holiday Inn Express, for example. Chris didn't care for country inns or B&Bs. First of all, you felt like you were in someone's house and had to tiptoe around, no matter how they disguised it. And second, you weren't crazy about parking right in front of one of them, where your vehicle and you seriously might end up standing out if something were to happen. You trusted Ned by now, of course, mostly, but to wholeheartedly embrace and address his issue, Chris figured you better make sure the guy was worthy of being addressed, meaning that he wasn't just some guy that Ned had an issue with once in a pickup basketball game, and that the guy had been his sworn enemy ever since. If Nick was really in his 60s, that would admittedly put him 20 years older than Ned, so the basketball example was less likely. But either way, you still were responsible for your own due diligence. Chris had been getting more lax about having to use a public and theoretically untraceable, back to him, computer for these final researches, and sitting in the diner, pretty comfy, having added the brown and tan special to that original Coke, a local dish that featured bacon battered in beer, and pretty dang amazing, he decided it was safe enough to use his phone. That realistically, if it came to a point where they're checking on you on that secondary stuff, you were likely in much bigger trouble on the primary stuff, and Chris thought of Mark again, the amazing work but the ultimate failure, and geez, you needed to block that all out right now. So Chris Googled, Nicholas Nick Protonchio arrest record, and before he clicked entered, he inserted the tank too, since you'd assume Ned wasn't the first one to ever call him that. But the point, obviously, you want to make sure this guy actually did something beyond perhaps loosely directing Ralph to make an inquiry in Manhattan Beach and finding out he ended up in a marsh a quarter mile south of one of the Panda Expresses in Torrance. It was confusing. His name showed up, or partially did, various places, not necessarily criminal ones, and it was like a bear to put it together logically and get that concrete conclusion you wanted. So Chris tried it again, substituting arrest record with going to jail. A lot less formal, but let's see what happens. Again, a mishmash, a lot of it different this time, but there was a link to one article from the New York Daily News that had potential, and Chris went there. Yonkers man sentenced to 8 years following manslaughter conviction by Jack Crinkle. October 16, 1987, White Plains, New York. A Yonkers man was sentenced today in Westchester County Superior Court following a manslaughter conviction last month in the death of 38-year-old Patrick Solowski of Red Hook. Nicholas Protonchio, 33, of 884 Regina Drive, was found guilty of slaying Solowski on the night of December 12, 1986, after Solowski allegedly ran Protonchio's doorbell and attempted to serve him with a legal document. Witnesses described a discussion between the two men on the doorstep of the Regina Drive residence and a subsequent escalation after Protonchio spit on Solowski's paperwork and, according to witnesses, told Solowski to go back where you came from, I'm not interested. According to court testimony, Solowski attempted one more time to hand the papers to Pratonkio, at which point Pratonkio produced a .32-caliber Belgian bulldog revolver and shot Solowski dead. Prosecutors had pushed for a sentence of 30 years to life, but Judge Helene Stewart, citing Pratonkio's community charity work and otherwise clean criminal record, imposed the 8-year term. In doing so, Stewart told Pratonkio that she hopes he spends much of his term considering his actions and can return to society a responsible member. Pratonkio will be eligible for parole in April of 1994. Welp, there you had it, Chris supposed. There could always be more to it, and things got watered or pled down by the time the court takes over. And sure, maybe poor Patrick Solowski hassled this a-hole a bit more on the doorstep than was portrayed. Process servers have been known to carry weapons, and conceivably he flashed something or mentioned it, igniting the tank to take it to the next level. Sure, all that can happen. Chris was convinced it didn't. That you side with law enforcement and witnesses and juries and the courts until proven otherwise. This guy didn't like getting served, and in his mind, his world, he made it go away. Then you had a sympathetic judge having the nerve to go on the record lecturing the guy while imposing the minimum sentence. That, or she was intimidated, and you can't rule out that part, and Chris supposed a judge would be only human if that happened. Chris put the phone away. You couldn't help wonder what was in the lawsuit or subpoena that contributed to the getting the poor guy killed. The article didn't say. It was something you might ask Ned about sometime. What was the thrust? But yeah, some other time. Chris had spent an hour in the diner at least. He continued into town, gave the main couple blocks the once-over, and there was a square right there too, with decorative old black iron fencing, sharp points on top, and a monument in the middle, some guy on a horse, and the horse rearing up. 119 Briggs was the in-town address that Ned gave him. It was an historic building, the whole downtown was, with its own little brass plate on the front, and the building was originally the ice house, it said, which you assumed was where they produced and stored the ice blocks people used in the refrigerator before real fridges were around. It was quite an impressive brick structure, subdivided into shops and offices, maybe 8 total, and there was an interior courtyard with some tall indoor potted trees, and quite a few chairs had been set up, and someone was dusting off the little stage up front. Chris heard someone say it was their Friday night art walk, the third Friday of the month. It didn't look like the art walks Chris was familiar with, but he was thinking what probably happened. People pop in and out of the galleries on the main 3 or 4 blocks, and then there's some finishing event here where they sit down, an artist maybe demonstrating something more intimate, or someone lecturing or otherwise unleashing verbal barrage onto the unsuspected crowd. Chris tended to be cynical, of course, with these events, since he'd sat through enough of them, but they obviously filled a need, so that's what was going on. Where would the tank be currently? Ned had forked over only the address of the building, no specific office or department. Had Ned suggested the tank owned the place? Yeah, he might have. There was a directory of off the courtyard near the stairs, and you had one listing by itself for Building Services B1. Might as well take a look. B1, it turned out, was in the basement, which you figured out by elimination, since the first floor units had G before their number, assumedly for ground, and the upper floor units had M before theirs for main, it seemed. It wasn't apparently that this place had one of those, a basement, since the stairs next to the directory only went up a flight, not down. This was going to take some detective work, and Chris casually searched the four corners of the interior building, looking for a secondary egress, and you had nothing. So you go outside, give it the once-over. There was a guy patching something tar-like on the side of the parking lot, adjacent to the building, and Chris was tempted to ask him but didn't, and went back inside, and a few people were filtering in for the lecture, and Chris thought maybe don't be a hero tonight after all. How about just take a seat and see what's on tap, like everyone else, and tomorrow's another day, and worry about the tank then. Which is what he did for a minute. It felt good to rest your rear end, even though that's what you were doing driving for a week. But even so. And then he noticed the far office to the right, set up a little different. There was an outer hall you went into first, and a door off that. And who knows? So Chris took a look, and no one seemed to notice him pushing the outside door or disappearing into the secondary one and down the stairs. It felt original down there, that's for sure. Very low ceiling. The brick walls needed an extensive repointing job. Barely any mortar left between them. One light bulb in the hall with a pull string hanging. You had a couple of maintenance closets left and right, an oversized low sink with a mop in it, and at the end of the hall, B1. Chris thought about knocking, didn't, and tried the handle, and the door was open, and he went in. He realized he should have tried to pull up a photo of the guy when he was Googling him, that there hadn't been one attached to the 1987 newspaper story, but all that said, this guy sitting at the desk in the one-room office, staring you in the face, sure looked like he'd acquired the tank along the way. Like Ned presented it, everything wide and massive up top, and then short little legs, which you couldn't see specifically, but the guy was sitting pretty dang low in the chair, wasn't he? It was tempting to lay it out straight, say, "Excuse me, are you Nick the Tank?" The issue there might be, though, once the tank began, was friendly enough, "I've been known to be, who wants to know?" Or easily some similar wisecrack, warming up to the main event, which could be pulling a gun out of the drawer, who knows, maybe even the same one still, as with the process server back then, and things could spiral out of control badly from there. So Chris said, "Excuse me, sir? Mr. Protonchio?" "What?" the tank said. Chris continued, "They sent me to report a power surge. Something with the microphone. It's cutting in and out. The lights, too, they are flickering." The tank stood up. "Goddamn Art Walk. Every month, some peripheral bullshit." There was an old-fashioned phone on the wall. No numbers or anything. Just a small light lit up below it, and a speaker mounted off to the side, the type you spoke into without using the earpiece. You could picture the tank being the type who wouldn't upgrade stuff if it worked fine, which this obviously did. It was also interesting to think that whatever scammy boiler room operation he was running out of here, it was likely to be a lucrative one. And why not go upstairs, take one of the real offices? You own the damn building. But this, too, probably fit the profile of the tank. Meaning the dingy basement room works fine. Why sacrifice the rent you're receiving instead from the fancy upstairs office? Chris was on that page himself, situations like that. You didn't need luxury and didn't need to show off. Meanwhile, the tank picked up that house phone and waited a moment, and then Arturo apparently picked up the other end, because that's what the tank kept calling him, and there was some confusion between the two how to handle it, the electrical business, and the call ended. And the tank seemed sufficiently distracted for a few more seconds, plus he was turned halfway sideways to handle the phone the easiest way. And Chris moved in a step and got the wire around his neck. First, not quite perfectly, a little off center with the leverage, and then he squared it up and was solid. You had the weird breathing sound you expected, and the guy reaching back towards you, and yeah, no exaggeration from Ned, big meaty paws, thick wrists, muscular forearms, though obvious fat in the mix as well. Chris held firm, the angle was locked down, all the physics in place, and soon there wasn't as much fight from Nick, and he dropped to a knee, and Chris adjusted himself accordingly. These were never pleasant, but as he waited out the tank, it ran through his mind with surprising clarity that when you separated out the less important parts, pared it down to its essence, this guy, either on his own or collectively, sent Ralph out to L.A. with the express purpose of sooner or later extinguishing his, Chris's, ass. Ned's too, if you wanted to get technical. So here, right now, you didn't have to relish this or enjoy it or take pride in it or even chalk it up to revenge. You just had to do it. Something sounded like water running and a door creaked and Chris hoped to God he was hearing things, and it wasn't from outside in the hall, it was from right here, and only then Chris noticed what was probably a restroom in the corner. A woman came out, finishing tucking her blouse into her slacks. Then her mouth extended to the wide open position, and Chris hoped it would stay that way, frozen open, no sound attached to it. But then the, oh my God, helps, started. But hopefully they wouldn't be a deal breaker since they were the only ones in the basement, and even better, there was heavy machinery humming in the hall, which Chris assumed was a generator for the whole building or the furnace or central air or whatever the fuck else was going at it out there, but it was effective. The screams diminished, and unfortunately the gal had found a pair of scissors on the tank's desk, and she didn't waste any time, though it occurred to Chris, if someone's choking out your man, you stab the choker guy in the eye or something, that should do it, but instead she went after Chris's hands, and it wasn't pleasant, not the least, but Chris maintained his grip. He was starting to think Nick had seen better days anyway. He felt awful limp and heavy down there now, but you better make sure. Meanwhile, Chris thought of something, remembering the name Ned gave him, the fourth wife, Lorraine. And you might as well go for it and see. And Chris said, Lorraine, listen to me. Look at me. This was scheduled. And he let that hang, hoping there'd be some effect. And at least she stopped the screaming, though she kept up the cutting his hands and knuckles a little longer, and then stopped that too. Chris let go of the tank, and it was a done deal. It was pretty clear her name was Lorraine, and that she was confused. Chris held up his hand, like, give me a second before you do anything stupid, and he started for the bathroom, but figured you lock the main door first in case Arturo came wandering in, explaining that he couldn't detect the electrical problem upstairs. Lorraine stood still, and Chris washed his hands as best he could, and whatever kind of soap they had in there stung bad, but that was probably for the best. So, Chris said to Lorraine, we move on. Things happen for a reason. You know that by now. I don't like it any more than you. It's nothing personal, babe. You know that too. Chris gave her a long look, and she was crying, which you didn't like to see, but the lesser of several evils, obviously, which included placing a call to the sheriff or constable or state troopers or whoever handled the stuff in this town. Chris also knew that as soon as he left, she would make a call, but that would be to someone in Tank's orbit. And Chris said to please pass over her cell phone and to wait here for exactly 7 minutes until it's safe. That those were the explicit instructions that he received, and that the phone would be waiting for her upstairs where the set of mailboxes was. Lorraine opened her purse, and for half a second, you had that terrible repeat alarm that she'd pull something snub-nosed herself out. But thank God she was complacent enough to simply hand over the phone and sit down. The lecture upstairs was in full swing, the audience section almost full, and Chris heard the expression, power of persuasive endeavor, resonating out of the speaker's mouth and over the PA system as he hesitated for just an instant, took a look, and got the hell out of there.